Hi, welcome to this week's program. The stock market's good, the economy's good, and businesses on the whole are doing well. This may mean for many employees that the extra compensation they receive through company stock option plans are really beginning to pay off. What I'm saying is that the other income you may receive in the form of stock compensation can be a major boost for your income, but only if you pay close attention and manage it carefully. You see, it's easy to mismanage employee stock options because there are a number of factors to consider in relation to exercising them. So today, I want to alert you to five key employee stock option plan mistakes that you'll want to avoid. The first one, failing to make your employee stock options part of your overall financial plan. One common mistake that people make with stock option plans is that they don't pay much attention to them. They tend to treat them like many people treat their 401k plan, as something they just put money into, they ignore, and they figure they'll look at it in detail later. But it's important to make this special form of compensation an integral part of your overall financial planning. Hopefully, you're working with a trusted financial advisor who can help you establish and manage a comprehensive financial plan that covers your income, investments, and retirement planning. If you do, don't leave your employee stock option plan out of your total financial plan. And a good financial advisor can help you determine how to best use your stock options to help achieve your financial goals. Another common mistake, and one you definitely want to avoid, is in not fully understanding exactly how your stock option plan works. Stock options can seem complicated because there are a lot of different variations, so it's critical to take the time to learn exactly how your plan works. If you're not sure you completely understand your plan, you can get help from either a human resources department or financial advisor or your accountant. Here are some of the basic features most stock option plans offer. The first one is your employer grants you the right to purchase up to a certain number of shares of the company, either at a specified price or at a discount from the current market price. Also, there is typically a vesting period before you can exercise your stock options. Now, a vesting period is the period of time you have to wait until your shares are unconditionally owned by you. This vesting period is usually just a few years, no more than 3 to 5. And the benefit may be guaranteed, or it may be dependent on either you or the company achieving some specified goal, like a certain level of sales or revenue. Also, there is often an expiration date when your stock options expire. If you haven't exercised your options by then, they're gone. This is why you have to pay attention. You certainly want to make sure you know that date in order to avoid missing it. All right, one reason you're including stock options in your planning calculations is that it's important to look at their impact on your overall investment portfolio. You don't want to make the mistake of having too much of your investment dependent on the fortunes of any one company, no matter how great you think that company may be. It's a good idea to periodically review your stock holdings and think about whether it might be a good idea to sell some of the shares you've accumulated in the company and then buy shares in other companies in order to maintain a well-diversified portfolio. Now, not considering the tax impact on your stock options is another mistake people make. Taxes are another area where stock options can get rather complicated. To avoid making costly mistakes in this area, I definitely recommend working with a tax professional. You may be able to defer paying taxes on shares you buy through your stock option plan until you sell them. You may also qualify to pay the lower capital gains rate on shares you sell rather than your ordinary income tax rate. The bottom line here is to get sound advice from a tax professional before tax time rolls around. All right, here's the fifth and final mistake: not knowing the stock plan rules when you leave the company. If you leave the company, make sure you don't leave your stock options behind. Typically, there's only a short time frame, such as 3 months, during which you can exercise any remaining stock options you have. And don't confuse the terms of a severance package with the specific terms that apply to your employee stock options. Now, if your company is acquired by or merges with another company, that may impact your stock options too. For example, you might be able to exercise options immediately, or your options might be converted to options on the new company's stock. Check with human resources to find out what that new deal may be. All right, here's a quick review. Make sure to incorporate your stock option plan into your overall financial planning. Know exactly how your employee stock option plan works. Handle your shares of company stock to maintain a well-balanced, diversified portfolio. Check the impact on your taxes before buying or selling your stock options. And finally, make sure you know what happens to your stock options if you leave the company. Now, I hope this helps you get the maximum financial gain from your employee stock options. As long as you manage your buying and selling of company stock wisely, your stock compensation can add up to a significant increase in your wealth and accelerate the success of your financial planning. Being well-informed is the most important takeaway here. Awareness leads to understanding, and understanding means you make the best choices for your future. And don't forget to hear this again, read it, or share it with your friends and family. Visit our website, stevepomerantz.com. Sign up for our weekly update where you can keep tap on a wide variety of interesting topics we follow every single week. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. I spend every day helping clients plan for and navigate retirement, and the question that comes up the most is, will I be spending more or less in retirement than I am currently spending as a working individual? Of course, there is no yes or no answer because we're all so different. However, there's a body of statistics we can use to get a good general sense of the costs. Some lower, some higher. Writing about this for Kiplinger Magazine is Brendan Peterson. He's a staff writer for Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Welcome to the program, Brendan.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Good to be here.
Let's start with those things that you'll spend less money on. Number one, transportation. Tell us about that.
Sure, we'd be happy to. I also want to give a quick shout out to the person who helped me report this story last year. That's Sarah Smith. She was an intern with Kiplinger, who did a lot of work with me on this story, so I want to give credit where credit is due.
Beautiful.
But as far as transportation goes, yes, for many people, one of the biggest reasons they'll want to retire, at least in terms of day-to-day aggravation, is saying goodbye to those rush hour traffic jams and long commutes. That's one of the big reasons that people go for retirement. Mm. The average worker spends like an hour a day, every day, commuting, and the time spent traveling to and from work is only increasing every year. But it's not just, you know, the aggravation that you're saving, it's also money. Before retirement, the average working household spends up to $9,800 every year on transportation. That number drops to $6,800 for the average retired household.
Yeah, pretty significant.
Yeah, it's a 30% decrease in household spending.
Right.
And that's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Okay, so there's $3,000 right there. What about clothing? I mean, working people have to buy nice clothes. We have to get them dry cleaned. Do clothing bills come down as well?
Right. I mean, you are supposed to dress for success when you are in the workplace, but when you're retired, you can actually, you know, put the stiff collars and high heels in your closet, and you'll save money from that. The average retired household spends about $1,100 a year on apparel, while the average working household is spending more than $2,000.
Okay.
And also, the factor is, of course, dry cleaning. Some people can spend up to $1,000 a year in some metropolitan locations. But, you know, in less urban areas, you'll save some money.
Absolutely.
Of course, it is worth noting, though, when you come out of the workforce for the first time in a while, you probably had a lot of, you know, work casual clothes saved up. But you might need to spend some more money on having clothes that you're comfortable in.
Yeah.
That there's a CFP, Rita Chang, who is based in Maryland. And she says she always sees spikes in spending from recently retired people who need to update their casual wardrobes after they're out of the workforce.
Yeah, of course. So you're going to amortize that over probably 25 years. You're probably not going to be changing that wardrobe too much. So it might not be quite that savings that you think. What about groceries? Are you spending less for groceries as a retired person?
Well, it's funny because, like, in theory, you're not eating more as a retiree. In fact, if anything, your appetite lessens as you age.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a huge component of spending money on food is convenience and time, right? The fact is, the average household spends 25% less on food in retirement.
Really?
There's a couple of academics named Eric Hurst and Mark Aguiar from University of Chicago and Princeton, respectively. And the logic is simply that you have more time to shop when you're retired. If you're not in a hurry at the grocery store, you're more likely to compare prices on similar products, use coupons, and you'll do more meal prep and planning meals ahead of time. You're also not, you know, buying food between meetings or as you drive in for work.
Yeah.
When you are, when it comes to dining out specifically, the drop is even sharper. It's like 35% less. Even though, like, you might have these visions of fancy steak dinners and brunches in your retirement, people manage to do that and still spend less money just by, you know, kind of cutting out these convenience costs.
Well, I have to tell you, not in my area, not in Boca Raton, Florida. I mean, it's it's a second career.
I'll tell you, I mean, for people who are, you know, if you've been living in the suburbs for a little while and you end up retiring to an urban location because you are trying to consolidate space and live with more amenities, that's not uncommon. You're going to spend more money in an urban area.
You know, I think maybe you're also shopping less down the middle aisles, the more packaged stuff, and maybe you're spending more time preparing your meals at home, maybe cooking with fresher vegetables and, you know, kind of shopping the outside perimeter of the store rather than the inside where the package area is. That may save you something.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. I think it sounds like you eat healthier and you spend less on the money when you are retired, which is pretty cool.
What about your mortgage? I mean, so many people, your statistics here, 82.5% of Americans 75 and older are mortgage free. How does that balance out for those who are in their 60s and so on?
Right. So compared to that 80% number for 75-year-olds and up, about 62% of Americans who are of retirement age but underneath 74, so 65 to 74, they don't have mortgage debt either. So that's a smaller pool, but that's still a lot of people who have paid off on that pretty huge, huge loan. But at the same time, housing costs certainly don't disappear entirely when you're in retirement. Even if you've paid off your mortgage, you're still spending money on home maintenance, and you'll incur moving costs if you want to downsize or relocate. But still, the average annual spending on housing for Americans who are, you know, between 55 and 64, right before you retire, is about $18,000.
Mm-hmm.
But once you're retired, it goes down to just under $16,000 for those who are between the ages of 65 and 74. And by the time you're over the age of 75, you're spending less than $14,000 a year on housing, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
There's this rule of thumb, and we don't use it, but this 80%, you spend 20% less in retirement than you do when you were working. Is that a high number or a low number relative to the broad statistics?
Oh, you know, that's tough. Because like you mentioned in your intro, it really can vary so much. And a lot of it depends on what your personal retirement objective goals are and what income you wanted to have versus, you know, how your portfolio aged in the last, you know, 10 years or so. It really can vary. But that's not a bad rule of thumb at all.
I'm speaking with Brendan Peterson. He's a staff writer for Kiplinger's Personal Finance. We're talking about the costs of retirement. And are you spending more or less than when you were working? Let's talk about the other side of the coin, spending more. Some of the things that you might spend more on, for example, travel. I think that would be something you would definitely spend more on. True?
Absolutely. I think even though you might not be commuting to work as much, that's one thing we mentioned earlier on.
Yeah.
Traveling and seeing the world is a touchstone of retirement for a whole lot of people, whether you're trying to pack in some luxury cruises or, you know, do weekend getaways with your grandkids. You're going to be moving around in retirement, especially in your early retirement. You know, compared to working people, retirees are, you know, opting for, you know, longer and longer cruises, for instance.
Yeah.
The main more destinations, according to Colleen McDaniel, who is a senior executive editor of Cruise Critic.
Okay, fair enough. What about healthcare? That's a big one. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that is one of the biggest upticks you'll see in cost. And that's not a big surprise, right?
Right.
We spend more money on medical care as we retire. The Employee Benefit Research Institute found that percentage of household total spending on healthcare goes from 8% in pre-retirement households writ large to almost 20% by the time a household is past the age of 85 average, in terms of averages. That's, you know, coming from unpredictable and costly diagnoses and hospitalizations. And overall spending is going to rise for general health needs, like prescription medicine, your insurance, and other services. So that's something that's unavoidable.
So some of these rising costs, like healthcare, will offset some of the declining costs. And it'll be interesting to see for each individual what the kind of the average is. I think it's a savings. I think you're spending less in retirement. You know, when we calculate whether people have enough money for retirement, we don't do a discount. We may put a bump in there for higher healthcare spending, but we project that out at an inflation rate going till till the 90s. And that's unrealistic, but we do that to be super conservative to make sure that we're kind of overestimating things. But I know that, you know, just people as they age, they do spend less, they go out less, and so on. What about day-to-day expenses? We're just running out of time. Let's take that as the last one.
Sure. Yeah, so as people transition into retirement, you know, especially in the early stages, most people's lives aren't radically altered. You might still drive out to meet friends or associates or, you know, go grab coffee from around the corner or use your laptop to do work from the comfort of home. The things that do tend to change after you leave the workforce, however, is who is picking up the bill for a lot of the small stuff,
you know,
like lunches parking or cell phone bills or even coffee. I mean, my God, when I worked from home after working in an office after I graduated college, the amount of money that I spent even just on buying packages of ground coffee beans was significant. I got my money's worth of coffee from my old employer.
Yeah. No, you know, also if you owned a small business, how much of those expenses were built into the business expenses?
Exactly. It's a lot, you know, and you can write a lot of that off. So a lot of people tend to be surprised by just how many of those little expenses that their company might have picked up, either their own or their employer. But that's something that you get used to over time, generally speaking.
Cool. Brendan Peterson with Kiplinger Personal Finance. And, you know, for all of you, it's just really a question of sitting down and trying to get your budget together and figure out, you know, what do you think your spending is going to be? And then as a year goes by, you're going to check that against your actual projections and see where you are. And if you constantly monitor it, keep on top of it, working with a financial planner, some kind of an advisor that can help measure whether you're spending too much or even not enough, which we see a lot here in Boca Raton, by the way. People can spend more, but they don't out of fear. Long story short, you know, having information like this is pretty important to you. So we'll put this link, a link to Brendan's article on our website, which of course is stevepomerantz.com, where we love you to visit and ask us a question. We love your questions as well. Remember that stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update where you'll hear all about our live events, as well as read a transcript of what we've discussed here or a summary, or actually listen to the audio itself. That's stevepomerantz.com. You know, I was thinking the other day that as summer has definitely arrived and life is slowing down just a bit, it would be fun to have a casual little get-together with all of you. Kind of like a bagels on the beach in Boca, only it's not in Boca, so we're calling it pastries on the beach in Pompano. Not a seminar, not a live event, though it will be live, of course. Just a meet and greet at a nice location where you can come and ask me questions about your financial life, and I'll try my best to answer them. This is also a good time to get a second opinion on your financial stuff, so feel free to bring any statements or documents you want me to look at. So what do you think, huh? We made a date, July 16th at 9 a.m. We're going to keep it to 20 people, and literally, we're going to have it at a hotel on the beach in Pompano with pastries, and more too, of course. Oh, and if that doesn't work for you, I'm also opening my doors for you to come into our office as well and experience the same thing without the bagels or the beach, though we are in Boca, and we'd love to see you at either location. Again, the date, July 16th at 9 a.m. It's at the Marriott Pompano Beach Resort and Spa. Go to stevepomerantz.com for information and to sign up. Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. Every year, I sit at the computer and start to compare my credit cards to others in search of greater benefits. This year, I decided to be smart, so I reached out to Lisa Gerstner, contributing editor with Kiplinger Personal Finance, to see if she's been following this topic, and glory be, she has done the work for me and all of you too. In her recent article, The Best Reward Credit Cards 2019, it fits the bill perfectly. Hey, Lisa, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, you know, it's a big effort and it's tiresome to go through all those cards and come up with the best. Thank you for doing that.
Yes.
What did you find this year? Anything new? Anything different?
Yeah, there's a couple interesting trends. One is that dining rewards are hot. A lot of cards are either adding those or they're increasing their rebate if you eat out at a restaurant or get deliveries. So that's a big one. And I also noticed getting a rebate on streaming services, so things like Netflix or Hulu or Pandora. Some cards are picking that up too. So that's something to look out for if you spend a lot in either of those categories. There are some options out there with those.
I also noticed that one of the credit card issuers was a new name to me in this space, and that was Uber. First, let's start with cash back, which personally is my favorite category. And I am proud to say that of the two top cards that you mentioned, those are the two top cards that I use. So I guess I'm doing okay. What was the first card, the winner of the flat rate cash back card?
Yes, we have Citi Double Cash MasterCard for that one. It's a very widely appealing a card. So you're going to get 1% back when you make a purchase, and then an additional 1% when you pay the bill for that purchase. So ultimately, you're going to get 2% back on everything you buy, which is a great flat rate if you don't want to think about different categories and trying to get this or that. Like, it's just anything you spend, you're going to get 2% back. Mm-hmm. So no annual fee. It's just a really easy card to use, and we like that one a lot.
What was the second one?
Yeah, so our honorable mention in that one was the Alliant Cashback Visa Signature. So that card comes from a credit union called Alliant Credit Union. So you do need to join the credit union to use it, which is pretty easy.
Yeah.
But especially if you're kind of a big spender, this is a great option. You're going to get 3% back the first year with no annual fee, which is a really great rate.
Yeah.
And then from the second year on, you're going to get 2.5% back. And then a $99 annual fee does kick in after that.
Yeah.
But like I said, if you're going to have pretty big balances on the card, that's a great option. You may get more back than just the 2% with Citi Double Cash. So just do some math and see which one might work best for you.
Yeah, I did some math some time ago. I think you needed like $20,000 to kind of break even on that $100 or that $99 charge. So you got to be spending a fair amount of money. Also, you have to be careful with these cards because if you don't pay the complete balance, I know in the Citibank, you don't get that at 1%. The second 1%. So you got to be careful there. These really are cards for people who pay off their balances every single month, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, the interest rates tend to be higher on rewards cards than on non-rewards cards. So it can especially hurt if you carry balances, rack up interest, that's going to eat into your rewards.
Yeah, you don't want to use those cards. Now, these two cards you just mentioned are cash back on everything, but most cards have cash back in rotating categories. Who's the winner there?
Yeah, this year we liked the U.S. Bank Cash Plus Visa Signature, and this card is interesting because it really offers a lot of flexibility in which categories you're going to get the best rebate. So there's a 5% category where you get to select two different options for your rebate. So there's kind of a preset list. And one new one that I think is really interesting is TV, internet, and streaming services. You can get 5% back on those. And I think for a lot of people, I mean, even if you've cut the cable cord, if you've got Netflix and Hulu and all this stuff, and then you're going to need broadband internet to do all that streaming, and that can add up too. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a compelling one. And then some other options for that category are cell phone bills, home utilities, movie theaters. You can take your pick of two of those.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So if you're not the person who's going out to dinner a lot, but you're the person who's staying home and streaming, this might be something of good value to you.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Take a look at those categories and see if they kind of fit your spending.
Okay. You have a category here called Cash Back for Savers Winner. What does that actually mean?
Yeah, so this one, we like the Fidelity Rewards Visa Signature because you're really encouraged to put that money away to get the best rebate. So as long as you redeem your points for cash back into a Fidelity account, and there's a pretty broad range you can pick from, so brokerage, 529, right. Their version of a checking account, retirement accounts, all of that, you'll get a 2% back rate. So similar to that Citi double cash rate, but you're going to have to put it into a kind of a savings type vehicle or an investment vehicle to get that good rate on it. So that's why we like that one. It really encourages you to put that money in a good place.
Yeah, of course, they're earning money on your money. And so they're able to kind of give you a pretty decent rate. So you've got to learn that. You've got to figure out what the system is and then learn how to manipulate the system in your favor.
Exactly.
No fee travel rewards winner, PenFed Pathfinder Rewards. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is another card from a credit union, Pentagon Federal Credit Union, and you can join that one just by making a donation to a qualifying organization if you don't meet the other qualifications. And what's special about this card is it has no annual fee, and it has a couple of perks that you generally don't find on cards that don't have annual fees. One is going to be a $100 reimbursement of airline incidental fees every year, and that includes baggage, in-flight food and drinks. It even includes day passes for an airport lounge associated with one of those airlines. So if you want to go hang out in the Delta lounge for a day and just get a day pass, you can get reimbursement up to $100 for that each year. So that's pretty neat. And then you also get up to $100 for a TSA PreCheck or Global Entry refund if you charge it to that card. So if you want to kind of zip through airport security and take advantage of that benefit, that's really nice too. And then you do get points for travel, so you can get up to 4 points per dollar on travel, depending kind of on your status with the credit union or military affiliation. Otherwise, 3 points per dollar on travel. So all around, it's just kind of a nice package for a no-fee card.
Yeah, but you know, you have to remember that if you're going to keep a balance and you're paying 17 or 20% interest, you know, that's going to erode the award's value quite a bit. So these, again, are really cards for people who pay their balances every month, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. Just make sure you're covering that whole balance and not spending more than you can afford charging on that card.
Well, people ask, why do I need a credit card? Why should I use a credit card if I'm going to pay my balance off every month? And I think the answer is that, number one, you can get money back or rewards back. So this is free money in your pocket, better than a debit card, which gives you nothing back. And then there's also some security with regards to purchases you make, right?
Mm-hmm. Credit cards do have better liability than debit cards in banking. So, you know, but legally, your liability is capped to $50 if there's fraud on your card. And then, you know, all the major card issuers, all those networks have zero liability policies.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if there is a fraudulent purchase, you really don't have to worry about it on a credit card, typically.
If you have control of your finances and you're good at that, or you really work hard to stay on top of it, and not let it get the best of you, it is wise to use a credit card and get all those benefits. All right, travel rebates worth the fee.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so if you are spending quite a bit and you're willing to pay that annual fee, the Capital One Venture Card, it's been adding some nice perks lately. So it has a $95 annual fee, but it is waived the first year. So you can give it a try and see how you like it. But generally, you get 2 miles per dollar on that card. And through January of next year, it's actually offering 10 miles per dollar on hotel bookings through a hotels.com portal that Capital One has. So if you're spending a lot on hotels especially, that's kind of an interesting rebate on that one. And then it's added a couple other things. So you can now transfer miles to participating airline programs.
Okay.
So those are mostly international carriers. It's not so much the big domestics like Delta or any of those. But if you happen to fly any of those participating airlines, that can be kind of an interesting perk. And then cardholders also get, again, that $100 rebate for TSA PreCheck or Global Entry.
Mm-hmm.
So some nice additional things in addition to the points that you get on that one.
Well, you get a sign-up bonus of 50,000 miles, too, if you spend $3,000 in the first 3 months.
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing. Yeah, a lot of these, especially travel cards, they tend to really offer some attractive sign-up bonuses to get you hooked in.
Yeah,
of course, you have to flip it. The rest of your spending, too, but
yeah,
it's pretty nice to get that extra perk at the beginning.
What I'll do sometimes is you know, get one of these high reward, let's say 50,000 mile cards, use them for the 3 months and then stop using them and, you know, get the reward and then go back to my cashback card. So not rocket science, but, you know, something that, again, understands the system and uses the system to my advantage. All right. Flexible Travel Redemptions winner, Chase Sapphire Preferred Visa. Actually, what does that even mean?
Yeah, so we like that there's a lot of different ways you can use the points you earn with this card. So yeah, Chase Sapphire Preferred, it does have a $95 annual fee. So again, you got to be spending enough to make it worth it. But there's some different ways you can redeem those points. They're worth about 1.25 cents each for travel bookings through Chase, which is a nice. We kind of look for a baseline 1 cent value for points. So anything above that, it is pretty good. And then you also can transfer those points to different hotel and airline loyalty programs. And there's a really nice set of these. You know, I know the last card I said, it's mostly international carriers. Not everyone's going to use those with the airlines. But this one includes Southwest, United, Hyatt, Marriott. Those are all included in point transfers. So we really like that flexibility that you can do a number of different things with your points and get a good value from them.
And there's a sign-up bonus of 60,000 points if you spend 4,000 in the first 3 months. Now, you said 1.25 cents per. Now, compare that to the cashback, which is 2% or 2.5% on the Allianz card. So now you can compare apples to apples and really what these points are worth. The reason that I like cashback, and I don't know that it's that's 100% this way, but I control the rate of inflation, or at least the Federal Reserve controls the rate of inflation on my dollars. Cash back, whereas these cards and the airlines themselves, they control the rate of inflation by making each point less valuable over time.
Right. And I think that's why numerous surveys I've seen have shown that people overwhelmingly prefer cash back because it's simple. You know exactly what you're getting. You don't have to think about, well, how much is this point worth and how do I redeem it? It's just much easier with cash back. Now, granted, sometimes with points, you can actually squeeze out a better value if you're really good at it, such as with this Chase card.
Yeah.
But you have to be willing to think about it.
All right, we're low on time, so I want to do one more because this next card has an annual fee of $450. What could they possibly be giving me to make it worth me paying that fee?
Yeah, so again, this is a card, if you're doing big spending on travel, take a look. So it does have a $450 annual fee, which sounds crazy. But for starters, you're going to get a $300 statement credit for travel purchases per year. So as long as you're spending at least $300 in a year, you're going to effectively knock that fee down to $150.
Okay.
And then after that, you do get some nice other perks. You get that TSA PreCheck or Global Entry refund. You get access to Priority Pass lounges. And then at certain hotels that are part of their program, you can get some extra perks. So for frequent travelers who are putting a lot of money on that card, it can be worth it. You're also going to get 3 points per dollar on dining and travel purchases as well, and 1 point on everything else.
We're going to post the link to Lisa's article on our website, which, of course, is stevepomerantz.com. And don't forget to hear this interview again. If you have a question about anything we've discussed, we do love your questions. Come to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com, and sign up. Sign up for our weekly update, too, where you'll hear about all of our live events and a summary, a transcript, and the audio for every single segment that you hear here. My guest, Lisa Gerstner from Kiplinger Personal Finance. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for a real estate roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So are homes still selling above the listed price? You know, about a year ago, we were talking about the market seemed really hot.
Multiple offers.
You were actually talking about maybe pricing it a little bit lower so you could get multiple offers. And you would end up actually selling it for more than you want.
That's right.
Is that still going on?
It is, but not to the degree that we had seen it. As a matter of fact, the share of homes sold at or above the list price dropped to 31% in March. That was about the same back in 2000, 2001.
Oh.
So
it's kind of normal.
Yeah.
More normal, but so
we had gone, yeah, and it, the peak was 40%. So we're retracting back a little bit.
Yeah.
So what does this all mean? It basically is saying that we're seeing a shift. This is another sign of a shift in the market.
Okay.
That's all.
And the shift is?
The shift is that the prices and the appreciation are deaccelerating.
Okay. That's a word for a diplomat, you know, or for a government official, deaccelerating.
Deaccelerating.
You are either accelerating.
Or deaccelerating, right? It's better than saying going down.
Yeah, well, that's exactly my point.
Right, I know. So we're just seeing.
Things are slowing down a bit.
Things are slowing down a little bit.
Home prices are starting to fall at all. You noticing a little softness?
A little softness, mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay,
yep.
Well, that's good.
But the market is still very strong, so don't.
Is it a buyer's or seller's market at this point?
It really is price range, Steve.
Okay, tell me about the price range.
So basically, depending on your marketplace here in South Florida, over $1 million, that's the luxury market. That's mm-hmm. definitely softer.
Okay.
If you're under, well, depending on where in the town you are, but under 500, mm-hmm. it's still a seller's market, or maybe definitely under 300,000.
It's hard to find. Is it hard to find good properties in that 300?
It is. And we actually have the issue that we're experiencing is just low levels of inventory. We're not seeing the sellers put their homes up for sale.
Under the 500. But I guess over the
million,
you
can get a good buy.
Okay. Also, Chicago and Miami had the lowest share of homes that sold at or above their list price. Chicago was only 21% and Miami was only 14% sold above their list price. So I think that says quite a bit.
Yep. Sure does.
All right. Looking at condos and the condo documents, there's nothing more boring than condo documents. Nobody really reads them. But the point is that as a seller, and this is the key to this, you are required to deliver all of the documents, every single page. Take us through that.
Yeah. So basically, and this is the state of Florida, we have 3 days for a buyer to review them. So mm-hmm. from the time that you give them to them. So as a seller, it's very important that you hand over those documents ASAP so that they can have their 3 days to review. I strongly recommend that if you are a seller, that you purchase a new set from the association so that you know that you are giving them 100% of all the documents that are included.
No pages missing, all the new amendments and things like that.
Exactly. Because I will tell you a personal story. Many years ago, a buyer wanted to back out of a deal. An attorney went through, looked through all the pages and discovered like there was one amendment missing.
Mm-hmm.
And based on those grounds, they're like, well, this wasn't 100%.
Well, so how much time does a buyer then have to back out if they feel that they haven't received all the documents?
Well, they have 3 days to review them.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I don't remember all the details in that specific case. Just know that there's opportunity for your deal to fall apart if they don't have all the documents. So
the buyer can cancel right at up till closing.
Right. If it's not complete.
If it's not complete. I mean, that's a really big deal because the buyer may want out.
Right.
They may be looking for a reason to get out. And here's a simple one. Oh, you left out 3 pages for some reason.
Right.
And they can use that and they can quit. Right. And there's no
recourse.
Because
you didn't give them, they didn't have the 3 days to review the whole entire document because mm-hmm. 3 documents were missing or three pages or what have you.
So if I'm made an offer to a seller, how much time do they have before they can respond to me and accept my offer?
Yes, that's always good. Well, in the contract, it says a date or a time, you know, a seller has till, you know, 2 business days, whatever the buyer writes in there. So here's where it gets hairy. People don't understand. In our Florida contracts, you have to respond as a seller during that time frame. Doesn't mean you have to have negotiated the whole thing out in those 2 days. So without getting into all the details, because it gets really, really complicated, the important part is when you're negotiating, when you're all done and you all are in agreement that the effective date is such and such, put that in writing. I would even put it in the contract. All parties acknowledge that the effective date to this contract is.
Oh, okay.
Because if somebody initials a contract and you're technically out of the time period there, an attorney could argue that this is an ineffective contract because it wasn't executed in the timely manner.
Okay.
So that's what's really important.
Dot your I's, cross your T's.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. So let's talk about one last thing. And that is, you know, in the unfortunate situation where someone passes away and, you know, let's say a parent or a sibling or a child has to then try to get their property to be dispensed with.
Right.
What happens if they don't have a will? I mean, what experience have you had in that area?
Well, personal experience, I just lost a cousin who had a house up in a different state of Maine. He was 61 years old. He passed away, no will, lots of assets. In the state of Maine, it reverts back to the parents. So fortunately, in this case, it's going back to the parents and it's being handled. I believe, and I'm not a lawyer, but in the state of Florida, without a will,
it goes to the state. Yeah.
So now that's messy.
Yes.
And so
time consuming.
Yes. And so if you own real estate and any assets for that matter, you can have a simple will. It doesn't even have to be complicated, but have a will. You don't want the states to be making decisions as to what you want to do with your property.
I think that's the best advice you can just give. Just get a will. I mean, if you really can't afford one, there's online sites. You can get them very cheaply. Just fill in the blanks. But have a will, because really it can be quite a mess if you do not.
That's right.
Okay. My guest, Terry Story, as always, a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You know, I was thinking the other day that as summer has definitely arrived and life is slowing down just a bit, it would be fun to have a casual little get-together with all of you. Kind of like a bagels on the beach in Boca, only it's not in Boca, so we're calling it Pastries on the Beach in Pompano. Not a seminar, not a live event, though it will be live, of course. Just a meet and greet at a nice location where you can come and ask me questions about your financial life, and I'll try my best to answer them. This is also a good time to get a second opinion on your financial stuff, so feel free to bring any statements or documents you want me to look at. So what do you think, huh? We made a date, July 16th at 9 a.m. We're going to keep it to 20 people, and literally, we're going to have it at a hotel on the beach in Pompano with pastries. And more, too, of course. Oh, and if that doesn't work for you, I'm also opening my doors for you to come into our office as well and experience the same thing, without the bagels or the beach, though we are in Boca, and we'd love to see you at either location. Again, the date, July 16th at 9 a.m. It's at the Marriott Pompano Beach Resort and Spa. Go to stevepomerantz.com for information and to sign up. Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. My next guest grew up in one of the wealthiest families in the United States. According to Business Insider, his personal inherited net worth in 2011 was in excess of $600 million. Yet, what makes him a fascinating subject is that he has produced two well-regarded documentaries about the world in which he grew up. His first, Born Rich, was nominated for two Emmy Awards. His second film, finished in 2006, speaks to the challenges America faces as a society in which 1% of the people control nearly half the total wealth. My guest is Jamie Johnson, the great-grandson of the co-founder of Johnson & Johnson. Hi, Jamie. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
So tell us about the point of view of the film and its original purpose.
The two films I've made really were both intended to look at wealth and affluent families in the United States in a way that no one had done before in a documentary film. And wealth is a topic that is often considered uncomfortable and is something people have a difficult time discussing publicly and sometimes even privately within their own families and among personal friends. And I thought, well, let's bring this topic to the surface and let's explore the subject in a documentary film. There are all kinds of difficult issues surrounding wealth and issues of inequality and things like that. And the films focus on many of those issues.
So the wealthy, and I would say we're really not talking about the 1% because, you know, a successful physician can easily be in the 1%. We're really talking about the ultra high rich now, really the 0.1%. Would that be more accurate in your view?
Yes, that's certainly true.
Okay. Those individuals as a group, and you were brought up in that culture, they find it difficult to talk about money amongst themselves as well? And also, what about interfamily?
I would say that families traditionally who have had wealth for multiple generations really do not like discussing money. It's something that's considered in bad taste. It's considered taboo. And I think that there's a long tradition of people being brought up in affluent circles, and they're taught from an early age that it's something you shouldn't discuss.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens then is many issues surrounding wealth, many times practical issues relating to investments and business-related issues, also personal issues surrounding wealth, wealth transference in wealthy families. Because the topic isn't discussed, many people don't succeed in affluent families on either of those fronts, even though they're raised in privileged environments and have great educations and have access to capital to invest. It's difficult often for them to find a way to be successful in business, and it's also difficult for them to find a way to be successful in their personal lives relating to issues surrounding money and how it's distributed and just handled and thought of within the family.
You know, there was a talk you gave, I believe it was on YouTube, and it was for The Moth, and you were talking about attending almost like a counseling session for the very wealthy. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? I thought it was pretty funny.
Yes, there are different groups that are support groups for affluent individuals, and you see more and more of this because as the world becomes more aware of socially conscious investing and socially responsible stewardship of wealth, which is gaining popularity in affluent circles, and there's a greater awareness around that topic, you have these groups being formed by young wealthy people, and the requirement to join the group and membership is often that you are affluent and you do come from money, and people talk about some of the benefits and some of the excess baggage that goes along with inherited money. Of course, when they're talking about what they feel some of the excess baggage is and what they feel the drawbacks of being rich really are like, it can often become kind of laughable, and it's easy not to have sympathy, obviously, mm-hmm. for people who have many privileges and sometimes want to complain about that.
Your father was, I think, noticeably torn in the video. You made multiple attempts to talk about openly with money, I think in a very kind of just casual way. And at the end of the video, at the end of the documentary, he's like, okay, let's talk about it. But he, you know, he kept, you know, self-stifling his responses and eventually just wasn't able to do it. And also what is ironic about that is that when he was, I think, around your age, he funded a film in the 1960s looking at the poor in South Africa. And your mom says towards the end of the film that he changed, you know, his kind of his personality or his way of thinking changed after he received a lot of peer pressure from within the family. So obviously he's your dad, and you know that was that seemed kind of like an awkward moment. What's your take on the way he was handling, you know, you making this movie and the way he thinks about the money as well?
My dad is a really private guy. So anything that comes up, any personal topic with him, he's often reluctant to discuss. And he was raised and taught from a young age not to discuss money. And I think that he often tried to instill that value within our own nuclear family. So when I said I'm making a documentary film and it involves children of inherited wealth and these topics are going to come up and it may be in the media, he had a negative reaction and he didn't want to participate and he discouraged me to do that. And we conflicted in many ways, as you said, and that's something that you see play out over the course of both films that I made. I think on one level, he's traditional. He's kind of old school that way. So he feels that the films I made probably shouldn't have been made, and these topics didn't need to be discussed and presented so publicly. And then on another side, he's a kind man and he is a loving man. And I think on a personal level, he supports me emotionally anyway, in that he's pleased that I'm making films and that it's meaningful to me. And he sees that I want to do it. There's a conflict for him, of course, because he doesn't believe that it should be a public topic.
Right. Yeah, that definitely came across in the documentary and made it that much more interesting, that much more real. You interviewed about 28 people, so I counted on IMDb. Only really three of them were individuals who had created their own wealth. The rest were former government officials, the financial advisors to the Johnson family, and the heirs themselves. Why so few of the people who kind of originated their wealth, as opposed to those that just kind of comment on the effects of the wealth and those who were the beneficiaries of the wealth?
I think I had less access to people who were self-made. So many of the people I know through the network of associations I have naturally come from multi-generational wealth. And I tend to know less people in my own life who are self-made. Also, because I understand through experience and through close observation the experiences of people who have inherited wealth and how multi-generational wealth affects individuals and its effect on society and culture, that's something that I really have a special understanding of. And so I tend to focus on that angle as opposed to entrepreneurs and first-generation wealth creators. It's something that interests me. And in the film, I interview a guy named Paul Orfalea, who started the Kinko's Copy Center.
Right.
Kane, and he sold that, and he's a very successful guy and an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And he was a pleasure to get to know. He's very forthright, and he's outspoken. And that's another thing that came up through my journey of making this film, is that you often see people who are self-made, and they have a little bit more confidence in speaking publicly about their money and their own success. One of the reasons why I think that occurs is because people who generate wealth, a lot of wealth in a short period of time, have a greater sense that they could do it again, and they have greater self-belief that they can earn money. And so they don't feel as defensive when people ask them about their personal wealth and their affluence. They feel that it's easy for them to say, I earned it, and they have a feeling almost that they could do it again.
Right.
That's not always the case.
You bring up this point that, you know, those who inherit the wealth seem to feel less confident about it and less sanguine about the trappings of wealth, and are, you know, there's this unease. As a matter of fact, two interviews, one interested me especially, was with Nicole Buffett, Warren Buffett's granddaughter. And, you know, I follow Warren Buffett a lot, as I'm an investment advisor myself. And, you know, I know the kind of culture that he permeates. But I was very surprised to hear that after the interview, in which it seemed like she was just being very simple and very honest and finding her way in the world, unless I missed something totally, the fact that he basically wrote her a very terse letter disinheriting her as a member of the family. Did that come as a shock to you? Was there anything in the documentary, maybe, that did not actually end up in the documentary, that would have explained that situation more fully?
There really wasn't anything that would have merited his reaction. He had a very strong reaction. And I think it surprised everyone, especially Nicole, who was in the film, and you described that she received that letter from her grandfather. I think it just speaks to this strong sense that people who are very influential and have a great deal of money and who don't want it discussed and who don't want personal things about their own lives revealed publicly, they react and they go out of their way to try and control the flow of information. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there are consequences for younger members of affluent families who step out of line, so to speak, and then they're punished. In this case, that came in pretty harsh form.
Jamie, thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to having you back on when you're doing your next project. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. You know, I was thinking the other day that as summer has definitely arrived and life is slowing down just a bit, it would be fun to have a casual little get-together with all of you. Kind of like a bagels on the beach in Boca, only it's not in Boca, so we're calling it pastries on the beach in Pompano. Not a seminar, not a live event, though it will be live, of course. Just a meet and greet at a nice location where you can come and ask me questions about your financial life, and I'll try my best to answer them. This is also a good time to get a second opinion on your financial stuff, so feel free to bring any statements or documents you want me to look at. So what do you think, huh? We made a date, July 16th at 9 a.m. We're going to keep it to 20 people, and literally, we're going to have it at a hotel on the beach in Pompano with pastries, and more too, of course. Oh, and if that doesn't work for you, I'm also opening my doors for you to come into our office as well and experience the same thing without the bagels or the beach, though we are in Boca, and we'd love to see you at either location. Again, the date, July 16th at 9 a.m. It's at the Marriott Pompano Beach Resort and Spa. Go to stevepomeranz.com for information and to sign up. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on The Steve Pomeranz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by The Steve Pomeranz Show or any media by which The Steve Pomeranz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show was obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.